Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast by baldmove.com. We're the officially unofficial podcast for HBO's Game of Thrones. I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
And we are continuing on our run of being the officially official podcast for Anthony and I's new book, Gods of Thrones, a book on the religions and cultures of Westeros and the real-life counterparts and inspiration, and also officially unofficial podcast for George Martin's Fire and Blood Volume 1, a book of fake history about fake Targaryens. Well, no, real Targaryens. they're just literary devices. This week, we are actually pleased to have a couple of special guests. We're going to have Kim Renfro on from The Insider. You may be familiar with her spectacular coverage of HBO shows such as Westworld and Game of Thrones. I had her on the podcast a couple times last year, and we're also, as a treat, going to be visited by our officially official artist for Gods of Thrones, who illustrated a lot of the big ticket things we wanted him to illustrate. Chase Stone is going to be by to talk about fantasy art. He's a noted illustrator from the world of Ice and Fire. He's done a lot of Magic the Gathering. I'm really, really interested in talking to him. It's going to be cool. But there is a matter of us getting through the final third of Fire and Blood. Kim will be helping us with that in a moment. But I also, since you know Anthony's been with us for so long now, I wanted to, before we kicked you out the door, I wanted to get your kind of impressions on the last third of the book. Oh
yeah,
you know what?
No, I'm glad
hold
not
on
to
a second.
Be kicked out. Go ahead.
Hold on a second. I fucked this up because I just went right past the Amazon review.
Okay.
Before we get to that, though, I want to take a little bit of time to promote Gods of Thrones because George Martin doesn't need promotion. Gods of Thrones needs promotion. It's still for sale on Amazon in both digital and paperback format. It still makes a great stocking stuffer or Christmas tree fortification for your hard to please Game of Thrones fan. If that hard to please fan is yourself, feel free to pull the trigger because I'm pretty sure you'll enjoy it.
It's also pretty irreverent, Aaron. You could use it for a book burning if you're into book burning. This would make a great option for that, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Although you should try reading the book instead of burning it. That note, courtesy of Henry Ford, Dr. Henry Ford Sr.
Very, very nice.
We had a Sean Connery. It's just a fun accent. It's a fun accent to try on and strut around.
Everyone has a Sean Connery accent.
That's because you just kind of you square off your ashes and give him a slight lisp. Christopher was one of the persons that graced us with the review on Amazon. Short and sweet because we got a lot of guests. We got a lot of material to cut through. Says, this book balances off-kilter humor with rigorous research to create an instantly essential companion text to A Song of Ice and Fire canon. It's also a beautiful book with great visuals and comes preloaded, thoughtful, and entertaining marginalia. I'm not sure if I said that word right. But,
no, marginalia is good. I think he's praising our side footnotes that actually exist within the margin. I love that word, by the way. It actually sounds a little bit dirty, which is why
it does. Like, I got the marginalia majora and the marginalia menorah. But, our book contains no mere footnotes, not to be trod over by the main text. Our footnotes are more like the sworn shields to the text. They're sturdy left and right arms in the margins. I don't know. I lost my metaphor there, as frequently happens. That's what's nice about writing a book. If you lose the metaphor, you can just be like, okay, keep writing. I remember what I want to say here. Podcast, not so lucky. Check out Gods of Thrones. If you have enjoyed this podcast, it's a mortal lock that you'll like the book. So check it out on Amazon. There's links in the show notes, as always, of where you can buy it. Hey, I want to take a few seconds before we get into the meat and the content to tell you what's going on here at baldmove.com, because we're preparing to enter our little annual hibernation period. We usually shut down Between Christmas and a little bit after New Year's before stuff comes roaring back. And man, it starts early. We got True Detective Season 3 coming up in January, a bunch of stuff. But right now, we are releasing our annual Christmas content. This year, it's themed a very Giamatti Christmas. We're reviewing the Paul Giamatti Christmas movies, All is Bright and Fred Claus, as well as having live watches for both of those. We're doing our extra festive drunken lunches on Fridays. And we also have The One Man Manger, a 8-part spectacular epic poem involving Paul Giamatti's desperate attempt to secure a last-minute holiday project. It's a whole thing. Paul Giamatti and Bald Move, he's kind of our official mascot at this point. So we decided to embrace it this year as our part of our Christmas celebration. And right now we're also discounting the club annual memberships. If you sign up for a new annual membership, you get 25% off from now until January the 2nd. So check that out. Hope you guys appreciate it. And you also get unlock all the fantastic club content. We've been doing this for like 5 years now. There's so many cool things we've done. Hope you get a chance to check that out. It's all at baldmove.com. You can't miss it. You'll see a giant Giamatti head. Click on there to either participate if you're a club member or sign up. Okay, let's talk about the final third of the book. We started with Dying of the Dragons, Rhaenyra Triumphant, which I, if you'll recall from last week, I naively thought that was the end of the Dance of the Dragons.
Yeah.
It was actually maybe the midpoint.
Yeah, I mean, look, these things, they die hard. In keeping with the Christmas season.
That's right.
They die hard.
The greatest Christmas movie of all, Die Hard.
Yeah, all right, so tell me, Aaron, did you have to force yourself to finish it, or were you sort of enthralled right through to the back cover?
You know, I was a little bummed with the... with the fact that we're still in the dance, because I really don't like... I mean, these are just Targaryens behaving badly. They don't give a shit about the realm. It's all about who has the better... It's a lot of boring and ugly stuff. But I found that as I kept reading, that the characters became, like, just in the telling of the story, fleshed out, that I started to, like, having a slight preference for one or the other. The dragon combat was kind of cool. I also, you know, I've heard about the Dance of Dragons, and I've read some, you know, material in the World of Ice and Fire, and for whatever reason, the narrative never sunk that this was just really a dragon holocaust. Most dragons of note die, and I think there's only two or three left in the land by the time we get to the end of it. Do you have, because again, I want to save some space for Kim and Chase, do you have another point that we should discuss before?
Yeah, no, I'm anxious to hear what they say too. There was only one other thing that I wanted to get your take on, and that was Cregan Stark.
Ah, yes.
And I was
thinking, Hour of the Wolf.
Yeah, right. Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. I mean, this last section was difficult for me to get through, but I thought he was one of the more interesting characters. Mm-hmm. And I was almost thinking about him as sort of an anti-Ned or a bizarro Ned. Because what do you think about Ned Stark? He's sort of forced into being the Hand of the King. He doesn't understand the politics in the South. Right. And he ends up getting eaten alive down there.
Mm-hmm.
By contrast, here we have this Cregan Stark, who's the Lord of Winterfell, who basically marches down south, and instead of being eaten alive, he really enters the scene after the Dance of Dragons is almost over, so everyone's exhausted and their resources are spent, and he kind of just takes over the place.
Yeah.
And in all of the things that Ned was really weak at, this Cregan Stark guy looks like he's just the perfect Hand of the King for this particular moment in history.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting because you're right. He is kind of the bizarro Ned Stark, because he comes... You know, Ned came with his household guard, just a handful of dudes. This guy has a host of like 10,000-20,000 Northerners, all prepared to die because this is at the dawn.
They think they're going to die.
Yeah, this is all the dawn of winter, and as he points out, like it's a northern tradition that for all the old men, the second sons, the men with not very many prospects, it essentially mouths the feed to go, and you know, in times of peace, they just go out into the forest to commune with nature, and you're understood that they freeze to death. In times of war, they make these fanatical like death and suicide marches, essentially.
Yeah, they're basically doing population control, using warfare at times.
Yeah,
for their own population control.
So you know, Cregan gets down there, and it's taken him a while to get down there because by the time he gets down there, essentially the Dance of Dragons is over. But he's like, "Hey, you've got usurpers and betrayers that haven't been to Nie yet. So I'm going to take my Northmen, and we're going to go to Hightower, and we're going to go to the Storm's End, and we're going to kick in some Baratheon ass and some Hightower ass, and we're going to get vengeance for this murdered queen of ours." And the people are like, "Oh, it's going to be so costly in lives, Lord Stark. What will you?" And he's like, "Every one of my men that marched forth with me is dead already." And he kind of explains that kind of badass Northern tradition. And he just can't be bribed. He can't be gainsaid. And unlike, you know, if Ned Stark had 20,000, if he had all the mounted Karr Starks and all the strength of the Last Hearth with him, it would have been a completely different situation. But yeah, it's so weird because, like, you know, Ned comes down there trying to keep worried about his life and worried about his friend's life. Cregan comes down there. Devil may care.
Yeah, and that's so, right. And this guy Cregan ends up, instead of conflicting with the women of the South, he ends up marrying one, and then he has all of these widows in the Reach. He ends up marrying all of these men off to these women because they're basically widowed, and here are these men that didn't expect ever to go back north, and there are no resources up there anyway because it's basically death up north. And so you've got this really in the Riverlands, at least, you've got this really strong marriage union, like in the hundreds, between the Tullys and the Starks.
Right, which explains, you know, which goes a long line to explain, like, you know, why the Riverlands are almost like honorary Northmen by the time of the Baratheon period, as we like to call it, the time of Game of Thrones.
Which is why Kat would be a natural, you know, a natural fit for at least one of the Stark Lords, right?
Right. So one thing it's like you mentioned this, but like at the end of it, when, you know, Cregan kind of gets beat down by the reality of the peace, because as he is preparing for war, all the knees start slowly bending because, you know, he had got there right as they had sent the Ravens to kind of sue for terms of peace. And like all the peace suing came back and everybody's kind of amenable to it because the whole realm's kind of done with fighting over this stuff. And you know, he then goes to met out the king's justice as far as trying to get justice for who murdered this King Aegon II and who poisoned him. And I mean, I found that, like, it seems like I'm not sure I agreed with all of his ways. I'm not sure I agreed with all of his investigative techniques and his standards of evidence and his ideas of jurisprudence and all that kind of stuff. And I was kind of horrified that, like, you're not going to like this guy, but he's going to chop off a bunch of heads, and I'm not even sure that half of them deserve it. Right. Of course, at the end, they all declare for the Black, and like all but out of the hundreds that people he had slated for death, only a small handful actually die.
Right, so it says that, look, if this was a southern lord, they might have just sort of dismissed the plea for the Black, but because Cregan was a man of the north, he had high respect and knew the need of the Night's Watch. And so, the first person that was going to get his head chopped off, he declared, "I want to take the Black," and then within like moments, hundreds of people were asking to take the Black.
Right. You know, and I think that's interesting because, like, I've always assumed that taking the Black was, like, something that you always, like, that was just always an option, you know? But it does feel like the way that was worded, where with Southern Lords, maybe like depending on whether they felt like it, they would give you that option if you wanted to take it. They're like, yeah, but you really did me dirty. I'm cutting your head off anyway. I wonder how much Cregan like added, cemented to this, like, well, you can always take the black kind of legacy of the the Night's
Watch.
Well,
that we see that with Joffrey, right? Eventually, you know, that was supposed to be an option for Ned, that he would actually go back up north and take the black. But Joffrey wanted also, to make a point.
You also wonder how is it that the Night's Watch has fallen so far in like less than 300 years, because you know, the time of Alysanne, like they had some castles that were crumbled, but they, you know, they had all of the castles garrisoned, and there's a lot, and they're just, their ranks swell through all these wars because everybody that you know doesn't want to lose their head takes the black. They've got, I mean, maybe it's that maybe something happened to their culture where they're unable to just take on, because like by my accounts they have almost 1,000 fresh recruits in the last 30 years alone. You know, there was like hundreds of those the faith militant that got sent up there, and I don't know, but they also, I think, didn't they rebel, and they had to be quashed too.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. I guess it would only take a couple hundred years for an institution like that to diminish if you lose
sure.
if you lose support. You know, it's not right. like these men are repopulating themselves. They've taken an oath to sire no children, right?
Yeah, and I'm acting like 300 years is nothing when, like, the country we live in isn't 300 years old. So I always assumed that the Night's Watch was, you know, like right after the Long Night, it's like the hot ticket. You know, everybody's like, oh, Night's Watch is great. They're singing songs about it. But like over the next thousands of years, it was slow attrition. But it seems like it's more of like, you know, something happened in these last 300 years that has, you know, really distracted people having them taking their eye off the ball.
All it takes is for one king to stop sending people up to the Night's Watch, and these men are going to be gone within a generation.
Yeah, that's true.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and ball move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was, and those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Okay, so we got a next. We got a couple of interviews, and then we're going to come back and do some feedback, and then we're going to wrap this whole thing up. So without further ado, we're going to go over to our buddy Kim Renfro to see what she thought of Fire and Blood as a whole in this last third, and then we'll talk to Chase Stone. So joining me now is Kim Renfro, who you have heard of if you've been a fan of Bald Move for some time, because we had her on a podcast last year a couple times for season 7. She's the senior culture reporter for Insider and has covered Game of Thrones, Westworld, amongst others. She's responsible for the definitive timeline for what's going on in Westworld. If you're familiar with Reddit or just internet investigation, period. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here with you.
Yeah, I just found out in kind of the process of inviting you onto the podcast is that you coincidentally are also working on a Game of Thrones book.
Yeah, and I mean, first of all, congrats on yours. That's so exciting, and
well, thank
it's
you.
Cool that we're getting a part two next
yeah,
year.
Thank you. So yours is kind of like trying to take in the whole breadth of the televised world of Game of Thrones, and what's the tagline for the book?
We're calling it the unofficial guide to Game of Thrones, because it's not we're not licensed officially by HBO or anything,
right?
But I'm kind of doing a chronological behind the scenes look at everything from how the show was first conceived of and created to behind the scenes details with the costume, the scores, all sorts of those kind of like fun stories that I feel like most super fans of the show probably know about, but maybe your average fan has like missed those interviews over the years. And so I'm compiling interviews that I've myself completed during the course of my reporting on the show, but also pulling from other sources and, all of the panels and Entertainment Weekly profiles and all those things over the years to kind of do a whole comprehensive look at the show.
So it's not so much a like a recap as it is a behind the scenes tell all.
Yeah.
From a fan perspective.
Yeah, totally from a fan perspective, and bringing in some of my own analysis, and I'm kind of known on Insider for doing the details of the episode that you might have missed along the way, and all like the references and stuff. So plugging those into more of a chapter by chapter look at the show is my goal.
Did you say that what your title is? Is it the unofficial history of Game of Thrones or
unofficial guide?
Unofficial
to Game of Thrones. Yeah, that's what we're going for now. Because it was actually history to start with, but we thought that maybe sounded too, I don't know, like that wouldn't really be as accessible for maybe the people who.
You're probably smart. As a guy trying to hawk a book on the religions and cultures of it, I wish maybe we'd come up with something, I don't know, the Motley Fool's guy, I don't know, something zany or fun. Okay, so now that we talked about your unofficial guide, we're going to talk about the official history of the Targaryen dynasty, the dynasty, as Charles Dance would call it. What are your overall opinions, just like real briefly, of Fire and Blood, and we can talk about the third that we're going to be talking about today, which is essentially two halves. One is the mop-up operations of the Dance of Dragons, and then what would you call that when the king's not a king yet, the minor, the Reginald period.
The Regency is what they refer to it, I think.
Yeah, the rule of the regents of Aegon mm-hmm. III, and he mm-hmm. comes to age at the end of this. What are your thoughts on Fire and Blood?
Yeah, I mean, overall, there are definitely some pockets of this book that were really compelling to me, and I was, you know, and you guys have talked about this already, from A World of Ice and Fire and some of the other books that Martin's put out, we already had an idea of some of these histories. And so for some sections, it was really just getting those a little more fleshed out. Mm-hmm. But there were also chunks of it where I was like fighting to stay awake, honestly, just because, I mean, maybe it's by nature of like how busy I am right now with so many other things. But there were just times where I was like, okay, another paragraph of like 10 new characters, eight of which are about to die in the next page, so like why should I bother committing these names to memory? And you know, there were times where it was a bit of a slog, but there are sections overall that that I liked the whole Dance with Dragons battle. I mean, it was brutal. I mean, talk about some of the worst and like saddest deaths, and like all the dragons, R.I.P.
Yeah.
But yeah, at other times I was like, all right, like another Hand of the King who's probably going to last for 6 months before there's some treachery. And
yeah, like Martin had this thing where like anytime the like a council was considering a marriage match or who should be the hand, they would do like six paragraphs, and each paragraph would be, well, Sir Dumbfuck of Hightower is a bluff and stout lord, but he was given to wine and he owed Lys a million gold dragons. And then Sir, you know, Harrybottom of Longleaf was, and it's like these characters are just introduced in a paragraph to sketch them out and say why they're not suitable for this or that. And it's you know, there's about half of this book is essentially the Council of Elrond from, you know, Fellowship of the Ring, which is easily, if you're reading Lord of the Rings in junior high or high school, that's the part where it's going to try to break you. You know, right. All this boring history and stuff. And but as you said, that there are some moments. I thought there was some kind of clever twists I did not see coming. Like King Aegon the second. During the dance, hiding in plain sight on Dragonstone, I thought was, because he had disappeared so long ago that I thought I'd just forgotten I'd forgotten about him, and I stopped trying to look for when he'd reappear. Even though it's classic Game of Thrones, you know, the guy you actually don't see him die on the page, so you should suspect he's going to come back, and him essentially taking over. The Dragonstone like stealthily and like building mm-hmm. his power on the inside and waiting for his sister to, you know, flee Westeros and then spring the trap on her. I thought that was a classic Game of Thrones twist and was fairly compelling in the reading.
Yeah, and he does it again with Viserys coming back for like to surprise Aegon the Third.
Yeah,
like that whole narrative and Lord Aelin. Alan, how are you?
I said Alan, and Alan. yeah, because I think sometimes he just likes to take English names and Westerosium, but
right, that makes so much sense. Here I am trying to like overcomplicate it.
Alan Valerian, Oaken Fist.
Yeah, I really liked his whole subplot, and so when that wound up threading in with, you know, the surprise presentation of Viserys, who is alive again, I thought that was really neat, and it was well crafted. But
Alan Valerian and like Cregan Stark, I think, are like the breakout stars of this third of Fire and Blood. Because mm-hmm. I thought Cregan was pretty entertaining too.
Yeah, I liked Cregan. I maybe overhyped myself when I read the table of contents at first and got to the, you know, the Hour of the Wolf, and I was like, ooh, like we're gonna get so much cool Stark stuff right after the Dance with Dragons. And then I was a little bit disappointed that he came and went so quickly, because I was really interested in him and what he was gonna do. So
yeah, I want to talk too, because one of the I started to like sit up a little straighter in my reading chair when we get to this particularly long and brutal winter, because we're 150 years into Aegon's reign, and you hear about the winters, but they never seem that bad. But then we get like this 4 year long like winter that's like the worst in recent Westerosi history, and I'm like, oh man, because that's a question I get asked all the time on the podcast, like, you know, what is winter actually like in Westeros? Does King's Landing freeze over? Does, and I'm thinking a 4-year long winter, shit's going to get real. Mm-hmm. But they mention it's kind of chilly in King's Landing, and the North has got is suffering from famine, but they still are able to go up north and attend a wedding ceremony in Winterfell in the dead of winter, 2 years into this winter, and they talk about it taking 3 times longer than it should. But I'm like, I thought the drifts were like 150 feet high around Winterfell in the middle of winter. Like, I just felt like the long, brutal winters just didn't live up to my expectations. The rest of the world outside of north of the neck seems like it just continues as it always does.
Right. Yeah. Like you said, aside from like the mention of famine, I think at White Harbor, right,
mm-hmm,
is where they say they get hit pretty hard.
Right.
That just like didn't seem to be the focus of our narrator here, which maybe a letdown.
I thought that I just thought that like when a really long winter came, that it would touch much further south. Yeah, like you would see snows and King's Landing and whatnot. But it's essentially like in most of Essos and south of the neck, it's like sweater weather.
Right.
Just put on another layer and you're fine.
It's like LA versus Alaska. Like what happens winter here? It's like, oh no, it's a little foggy.
Right. Did I just see a snowflake? But no, I was kind of like bummed, and I'm like, well, maybe it'll get, you know, because then later in that third, they started talking about, you know, some of the stuff that was going, and I thought that they were going to return to Winterfell and the North and how the Regency was going to kind of solve that problem. But yeah, Cregan just took out a fat loan from the Iron Bank and he bought a bunch of grain and everything was cool. I didn't have time to like compare this to what we already knew in the world of Ice and Fire. Like, you know, get out the two texts aside.
Yeah.
I have the paper version of it and it's packed because we're in between studios and all of our shit's in storage right now. Mm-hmm. But I thought the storming of the Dragon Pit, there's a lot more detail in, like, because it was always unclear to me, like, why the commoners would do something so rash and crazy as storm the Dragon Pit. You know, it's like, mm-hmm, attack Jurassic Park except for the T-Rexes breathe fire. Mm-hmm. And I thought they did a particularly good job of showing just how terrified the small folk were of the Dance of Dragons, and mm-hmm, how scary that would be to see those things fighting above the air. And then you get a religious leader that steps forward and says, you know, all your problems are brought on by these dragons and their dragon riders and their perversions and their filth, and you're never going to be free from them unless you kill them. Like, It felt more of like an act of desperation, because like the, mm-hmm, the drumbeat of war just kept on beating louder and louder, and you know, they made it very abundantly clear how bad it is to be sacked in this book.
Yeah, definitely. And I liked that we can see those parallels in what's happening now in A Song of Ice and Fire with like the Faith Militant and the Sparrows, and sort of this idea that like you can only terrorize the country for so long before something's gonna rise up, and like whether or not that's successful or not is another discussion to be had. But it was very like palpable how terrible it would have been to be shut, because like she had shut the gates at that point also, Rhaenyra, so like the idea of being shut into this city where like conditions are just getting worse and worse, and they had been taxing the people, mm-hmm, basically to death. And I felt like the whole Dance with Dragons, I found myself not really rooting for anybody, but fully understanding where all of the players were coming from in their actions, which is interesting.
The Dance of Dragons felt like Game of Thrones, except for there's no Jon Snow, there's no Daenerys Targaryen. Everyone's either Cersei or Tywin,
mm-hmm,
or I don't know. There's not even a Lady Olenna who's like a clever. There's no Varys. I guess the Clubfoot guy was kind of a.
You mean Larys?
Whoa! Is that his real name?
I think so.
I wow, I didn't pronounce it like that in my head, and I'm like, oh my god. I mean, this is the same guy, because I got this in my notes to write too. He has a Lord Elmo and Sir Kermit. Of House
and
Tully.
Right. And there was a fourth Muppet too. I didn't write it down. Yeah, he did like a whole Sesame Street Tully thing.
Which, and you know, if like Lord Elmo, I mean, I kind of like perked my ears, but like Sir Kermit came right after that and the Grover stuff. Like I felt like that maybe should have been sprinkled throughout the book instead of, you know, like if you pay like every third generation of House Tully is going to be a Muppet reference. But he just went for like, it's the Muppets are all up and in the Dance of Dragons.
He's a
Varys type. Now, I got the distinct opinion that this guy was in it for himself and for very kind of like selfish, either survival or accumulation of power. And do you think we're supposed to maybe see Varys through that prism? Or,
I mean, maybe because I immediately like linked the two in my head when he first cropped up. I sort of was reading what he was doing as possibly being for the realm in the same way that Varys acts that way. Although, it's tough because when in A Song of Ice and Fire, we have Varys interacting with all of these characters like Ned and so forth. And because we don't have any like real first person account of what Larys, I'm just going to keep saying it.
Sure. Larys.
What Larys is doing. It's harder to like feel confident in that, but I don't know. I found myself believing that the reason why he kept like flip-flopping and doing all these little machinations behind the scenes was because he was trying to get someone who was more stable on the throne. But,
and even in times of instability, trying to blunt that as much as possible. Like these, we are like, it's like there's several points at Dance of Dragons where there's not any really good options available. There's just less bad, and invariably the damn Targaryens would choose the worst bad because you know, fuck those other, fuck the greens or fuck the blacks, if depending on what side you're on.
Right.
I did not know this detail, and it might have been in other sources, but I did not know that Targaryens chained themselves to their saddles when they rode a dragon, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, the only reason why I knew that, and possibly why I enjoyed the Dance with Dragons sections of the book so much more, is because I had watched, did you see the season 5 bonus features on the Game of Thrones DVDs where they did like animated versions of some of these histories?
Yeah, no, I've seen those through season 6, but it's been 2.5-3 years for the season 5 stuff.
Yeah, so I went and rewatched the Dance with Dragons one, which is like 20 minutes long. And so because I had rewatched that somewhat recently, I already knew like the main beats of the story, and one of the things that they specifically mentioned in that was the whole thing with Darren not strapping himself to his saddle so that he could like use Dark Sister and kill
which is pretty badass. Although
I think that was my favorite section,
especially since it seemed like it was unnecessary. It's like stabbing to death a jumbo jet pilot who's in a terminal tailspin. Like, you're not walking away from this no matter what, but just to make sure I'm gonna leap from my dragon's back onto yours as they're crashing to the earth and jam this Valyrian blade through your eye hole.
Yeah.
No, I was wondering, because like I wonder if that will, I wonder why some of these kind of details like exist, because you know there's only one dragon rider on Game of Thrones, the television series. Do you think that's going to change in season 8? Do you know? Have you got any leaks? Okay.
I don't know. I mean, I would guess that Jon is going to ride a dragon.
Yeah. But because Dany doesn't use saddles, does she? As depicted on the show?
I don't think so. If she does, they haven't made it very clear.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I don't think that she does. Because like, seems dumb.
Yeah, no, like, yeah, no.
Like a terrible idea.
But no one's like taught her, no one's taught her better, and there's no like dragon saddlers around. I always thought that like, early Tyrion seasons, exactly. The whole Tyrion whip up some kind of saddle, and that was going to be key, and, you know, I'm just wrong about everything.
I mean, I feel like that's probably going to be the case in the books. Mm. It seems like one of those details that maybe is not, like, it's not important to the point where, like, George told Benioff and Weiss that Dany dies by falling off her dragon because she forgot to
put her chains on,
strap herself down,
the safety, like, straps.
Yeah. So maybe that's just one of those details that the show kind of, because I mean, if I can imagine that that's like one more headache for them to try and CGI on.
Yeah, there's obviously going to be a lot of differences. You know, like, George made it pretty clear that dragons, for whatever reason, don't want to fly north, and we talked about this in the previous podcast, but that is not even a thing in the television show. And it's really, right, stuff like that's really made me wonder how wide the drift is going to be between whatever George is planning on for the finale and what the Dan and David have come up with.
Mm-hmm.
I also thought, you know, a lot of pretty regressive worldviews in Game of Thrones, as you suspect, but there's this interesting perspective in Gaemon Palehair, who was one of the three kind of false kings that briefly ruled King's Landing in between, like, there's this power vacuum after the Dance of Dragons. And, you know, there's a couple of these guys that set themselves up as kings. And they've got, you know, this guy's, I think, his claim to fame was that he said that one of the kings had visited his mother, who is a prostitute, and he's his illegitimate bastard. But anyway, the Maester Gildane is talking about his edicts, and he describes each one he gives as more ridiculous than the last. But they're things like, women should be equal in terms of inheritance. The poor should be given bread and beer ration in times of famine. Wounded war veterans should be looked after by the house that they have sworn them to.
Uh-huh.
Men who beat their wives should be tried and beaten themselves. Like, yeah, it's funny.
I flagged that so quickly.
Yeah.
Like, look at Gaemon Palehair and his, like, democratic socialist policies.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, these are things we have in modern... these are all essentially things that we've implemented, but they're unthinkable in terms of Game of Thrones universe.
Mm-hmm. I also love that it's like, because Gaemon Palehair is like 4 years old when
right,
he's crowned, and so really those policies are the product of the I think it's like a Dornish woman, and the person, like the sex worker who's his mother, who says that, you know, this Targaryen was the one who impregnated her. But like, so I'm like, okay, so we, and it says that they like are companions, or that they like sleep together. So I'm like,
yeah,
the like the most like progressive policies are put forth by like two queer women who are
yep,
like, just trying to do right by the people. And I'm like, this is amazing. And then of course that doesn't pan out for either of them.
I kind of want to hear more about those stories. And I also wanted to hear more about Dorne, because I've always thought Dorne sounds like the most screwed on heads of any, like, if you're not a man, you want to be born in Dorne. If you're not a man of impeccable birth, even if you're not a man, a true born man, you definitely want to live in Dorne, because they're not really anti-bastard, not really anti-women. It seems like their inheritance is a lot more fair and equitable than the Westeros itself. So, but we didn't get a lot of Dorne. There was a lot of pacification of Dorne in the first kind of section, and then they kind of threaten rebellion here and there. But I felt like Dorne and the North were kind of unrepresented in these books, which I thought was surprising.
Yeah, I did find myself wishing I was reading a different fake history, or a different, you know, fictionalized history. Because, I mean, I think at one point, again, in, like, the aftermath, after Aegon III is finally seated, and they talk about the Widows of Winter and how everything probably would have descended into chaos again if not for these women who all made, like, very smart diplomatic choices.
Right.
And he writes that there's another archmaester, I think his name is Abalon, who wrote a book called When Women Ruled, Ladies of the Aftermath. And I'm like, I want to read that book. Like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
That sounds way more, I don't know, less biased telling of how really so much of this chunk of history in Westeros was dictated by and like held together by women. But of course the maester who we're reading it from doesn't hold those women in the regard that other people might.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting because, like, you know, I think of, like, our recent past. There's been a pretty sharp uptick in, like, you know, women's rights in the last century, like, you know, being granted suffrage, and then, like, as a result of war and women being pushed into the workforce, that, you know, gained more acceptance there, and birth control. I mean, I let me mansplain you women's liberation, Kim.
Oh,
but, like, I thought it was interesting that you had essentially so much female rulership because of war, the winter, and the famine. There's mm-hmm. so many widows, and they're kind of running things. I kind of thought it was weird that didn't spark, like, more change, because yeah. you know, Westeros 150 years later looks a lot like the Westeros of 150 years hence, and, like, a lot of the same pressures that our society went through that kind of, like, you know, pushed these changes. And, you know, like, once women got in these roles, it's like, well, they're not gonna be chased out of them. I guess, you know, that'll be part two, is, like, how did they lose that progress? But it does seem like that there's a lot of, every single time someone suggested, like, well, maybe you let a woman inherit. Like, that was always, they love to go back to, like, no. Women can't inherit. Every time we let them, things go bad. Right. And it reminded me a lot of, also, there's a comment about bastards, this throwaway line about how, you know, this one, there's this one bastard it's the two dragon seed guys that go rogue.
Hammer. Yeah, the
hammer and the drunkard. I forget which the other guy's name. But when they turn cloak, it's like, oh, well, what do you expect? They're bastards. And I'm like, dude, everyone in this book thus far has been trueborn, and there's been no shortage of betrayals and fuckery.
Right.
It's kind of like one of those things where 10 noble lords can do something, but one bastard does it. And it's like, ah, see, here's where you can't have a bastard in a position of power. Same way, like 50 noble lords could do whatever, and a woman gets in a position of power and makes a mistake. It's like, let's see.
Yeah.
Look, that's what happens.
I do think, like, the failure of Rhaenyra to win this, like, civil war, I think maybe took a lot of the wind out of the sails of any sort of possible beginning of a progressive, like, women's liberation movement or whatever. Because I think had she been able to succeed, that might have been the beginning of a turning tide. But because she failed, and because she became so paranoid and, you know, kind of Cersei-esque in like the final year of this fight, that kind of reinforced the bigotry to all of the lords around her, of being like, mm-hmm. see, like, this was obviously a terrible idea. Like, look at how bananas she's gotten. And, like, I don't know. So that, it kind of makes me wonder if the reason why we're getting this history, and, you know, we're getting the truth laid out that all of these women had these great ideas and were able to kind of control things after all the men had been so decimated, might be like the precursor to Daenerys trying to do effectively the same thing. Because mm-hmm. what we're told throughout this, especially like this final chunk, is that all of these lords still do not think that a woman can ever be fit to rule, which means that Daenerys is probably going to run into similar issues when she lands on Westeros. But it's interesting that by the time we get to A Song of Ice and Fire, we also have Cersei, and we also have, you know, Sansa kind of vying for power, and Margaery, and there are more women who are highborn and kind of playing the Game of Thrones, whereas in this chunk, it feels like most of the women are happy to be kind of relegated to their husband's sides, even though they are still exercising power. So, and I mean, we're, as much as we're seeing parallels, I think, with what Dany's about to face, it's the same with Jon. I mean, like you were just saying, all of this bigotry against bastards, it's like Jon's potentially up against just as many contentions if mm-hmm. he tries to get close to the throne because of this idea that bastards can't be trusted.
So something I want to talk about is, it's been, you know, one of these kind of fan conspiracy theories that the Maesters were behind the death of the dragons. You know, like, there's like this conspiracy theory that's like, oh yeah, let's put them in this dragon pit and chain them down just, you know, to be safe. And maybe, like, the kind of stunt and make them smaller and weaker. And then maybe there was even some poisons or some other kind of arts were employed. I found very little support that. I mean, I'm sure you've heard of these kind of, like, Maester conspiracy theories before.
Yeah.
I found very little to support that in the text. It seems like it was just Targaryen pigheadedness, and because the dragons were large, powerful, and plentiful during the age of the dragon pit. So right. what went wrong?
I mean, the only window where I saw opportunity for people who really subscribe to that theory is when they first introduced the shepherd character. Mm-hmm. And he makes specific mention that, like, no one really knows where he came from or why he had such, like, a bias against the Targaryens and their dragons. And so that kind
interesting
of piqued, that kind of piqued my interest, because I was like, he could very easily have been a plant by someone smarter who knew that, like, they needed someone who kind of looked a little ragtag and worse for the wear to start, like, preaching and riling up the people against the dragons. So I didn't, like, yeah, I didn't see any direct evidence in terms of, like, the creation of the dragon pit and thus, but I think that the shepherd is possibly there as a stand-in for someone else who was behind the scenes and wanted the dragons gone.
Yeah, it's because there's other, you know, conspiracy theory we've talked about on the podcast about essentially the Faith of the Seven being an engineered religion from the Citadel. And so it would be interesting if they used him as like a cat's paw to, like, and that's the other thing is, like, I feel like that now if you're in this maester anti-dragon conspiracy, like if you're a Marwyn, subscribe to Marwyn's thoughts that the maesters had something to do with it, that it's no longer something that they had like a long plan for, but it's more of like an opportunistic thing. Like, oh, yeah, look at these Targaryens at each other's throats. There's very few, like the dragons have been shrunk down to like a small enough population to where we could, with one decisive action, if we could whip everybody into it, we could take these things off the board.
Right. Yeah. So. I mean, I think that's very possible, because something about the shepherd just seemed off to me. And the fact that, like, yeah, that our maester here decided, like, specifically pointed out that no one really knew where he had come from or what his motivations were.
Yeah, there's the only negative about that is at least a dozen. There's half a hundred characters that are introduced like that in this book.
True.
There's many and more.
True. I know.
On the nonce. Okay, I thought it was also interesting that there's a couple of books that there's a couple of mysteries that the book intentionally sets up, like what happened to Sheepstealer and Nettles, that they resolve, and there's been hints before that the Burnmen Mountain Tribe or Mountain Clan were like founded by this fire witch that lived in the mountain, and I feel like that the final, in this book anyway, the final disposition of Sheepstealer Nettles is setting her up to be that fire witch.
Yeah.
Like these guys that have to offer parts of themselves to their god to be burnt, and that's how they gain honor, and they're the most ferocious, and they're also the most dominant of the tribes. Like, it seems like somehow she had recruited them as her followers, and with her, you know, power, with I guess her dragon, although it's kind of hard to see how a dragon would be flying around the Vale and nobody would be like, hey, there's a dragon out here.
Right, because I guess, like, when they stumble upon her, she's in a cave, and I'm like, right, isn't that going to, like, weaken your dragon if you're keeping him just in a cave for the rest of his life? Although,
it does seem like that's her natural habitat, though. Like, yeah, dragons left to their own devices like to roost up in the, you know, the mountains of Dragonstone. And
I really was interested in Alice Rivers, the paramour to Aemon Targaryen, who, like, that was another one of those twists where when she showed up at Harrenhal and, like, had his bastard son. But if I reread that section, and, like, she never says what his name is, but she says that he has a claim to the throne because he's a trueborn son, because, like, she claims that she was married to Prince Aemon. And he left that open-ended, so I guess we're gonna have to wait for volume two. But that was a character that I really gravitated towards, mostly because of all the Tower of Joy parallels. Like, them kind of holing up in Harrenhal together secretly was I liked that little thread.
They also had that detail where she's possibly got sorceress powers. Because Aemon mentioned that, like, you know, she had seen, he knew where to find Daemon by essentially seeing a vision out of the smoke and fire, which I thought maybe puts her in a little bit of a Red Priestess territory. Like, she's converted and we'll find that out. There's also a lot in Volume 2, which, you know, the big, it's the Blackfyre Rebellion, which is the big thing to look forward to in Volume 2. And there's a lot of talk of, and because I remember, like, you know, doing some fan research and going through the World of Ice and Fire, there's a lot of talk about, like, that Sierra Sea Star and how she dabbled in the dark arts with her paramour, Brendan Rivers, and he's kind of a warlock. And I wonder if, like, she's the start of the dabbling of Targaryens with witchcraft.
Yeah, maybe. It's funny because when they first introduced her, and I can't remember if it was before or after the whole section on nettles, but, like, at first I was kind of rolling my eyes because I was like, this maester just obviously thinks that, like, if a not attractive woman gets in bed with a prince, that she must have somehow, like, magicked him in there, because there's no possible way that she could have, like, found her attractive. Because
she's, like, 40 and he was 20, right? That was the whole...
Right. But, like, when, yeah, like, after the whole Harrenhal thing and the whole thing with, like, the messenger that she sends back, and he says, like, you can't laugh at what I'm about to say, otherwise she'll kill me. And then the one laugh and he's, like, strangled in front of everybody. I was kind of like, oh, okay. Like,
yeah, because they did that Scooby-Doo thing where, like, when you first meet her, she's, like, on the battlements and she's issuing these challenges through the lore. And then somebody says something to her and she makes a motion with her hand and his head explodes. Mm-hmm. Right. But then the Septon's like, oh, but, you know, that could just be a signal to hit him with a crossbow bolt or this fucking mushroom guy, which I really did not like. I really did not enjoy Mushroom, and I'm glad to see him definitively shuffling off into the pages of history by the end of this book. But he's like, oh, yeah, someone could have hit him with, like, a metal ball from a sling. And I'm like, oh, okay. So it's like, you know, early goings of Game of Thrones, or is it magic? It might not be magic. And then, you know, I don't think there's any explanation for what later happens. If that's, like, a true telling, as this maester says, that's just magic. It's long-distance magic.
I really liked Bela and Rhaena, the twins. Who Bela is, like, the one who ultimately kills Aegon II's dragon and blames his name. But they, I think that, because, like, Bela and Lord Allen, like, I was really digging both of their characters when they
They're a power couple.
Yeah, and when they got together, I was like, ooh, yes, like, I dig this. So, yeah, and again, I wanted more of them. I was a little bit bummed that they had been relegated to, like, a sort of side story, but I thought that those twins were really interesting, and I'm already pre-mourning for Rhaena's dragon, since obviously something terrible is going to happen to him.
Yeah, Aegon III's not called the Dragon Bane because dragons proliferated during his reign. I too was a little kind of bum, because they lead this up, and when they get married, the maester says something about, you know, that this is the one of the stormiest relationships in Westeros, and I'm like, wow, that says a lot, because there's been some freaking stormy ass relationships so far in this book. And yeah, they got in a fight over some, I forget, miss, because he talked about the princess of Dorne a little too warmly, and she got mad at him, but then everything got kind of papered over, so not really. And I'm like, oh, I thought, because I thought, I really liked Jaehaerys and Queen Alyson. I thought that was kind of like the high water, and I thought that, oh, we might get, like, a part two of that, but it never really quite took off. But he's still got a lot, like, we've already been on two of his six famous voyages so far.
Yeah.
So there's still there's still room for more tales of her and him, and is it Bela?
Yeah.
Okay, because, man, that's the other thing is, boy, keeping track of all these Targaryens with their very similar sounding names and spellings is very tough. Very tough for me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Bela stuck out to me because she's another kind of, like, Arya precursor, I felt like, in a way, where it was like she was one of the sisters who was more, you know, he loves the word willful. Like,
yeah.
You know, God forbid she have a mind.
Willful and lusty are the things you don't want to be in this book, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. But
Yeah, I liked it. And you're right. There is a very Arya Sansa, because her twin, they were separated and raised and fostered in two very different environments. And then when they come back together, although they get along a lot better than Sansa and Arya.
Right, and they got along before they were separated.
Right.
But yeah, I was still seeing those parallels there for sure. Another name that I flagged was one of the random characters whose name was Ned Bean. And I was like, is that like a Ned Stark
show? Oh, shit. The Black Bean, wasn't he?
Yeah. Because they call him Black Bean for most of the time. But when they first talked
about him,
they gave his name Ned Bean. And I was like, aha.
Yeah. He does like doing that. There's a long history of him, like, you know, putting Bill Belichick in there. And
the Giants getting beat by...
Patriots of
So that was just another fun one that I noticed. And it's just, I mean, overall, I understand the way that George has reserved the right to change any of this or to have it actually not mean anything, since he's writing it from this unreliable narrator point of view. But it makes it even harder to try and like suss out those things. But there's weird stuff. Like, I know you and Anthony talked about the three dragon eggs that were stolen, mm-hmm. and it seems very obvious that those are probably Dany's dragons. But back in April on his blog, like when he first did the big Fire and Blood announcement, he got real prolific in the comment section of mm-hmm. that post. And someone said like, oh, can't wait to find out the origin of Dany's babies, because the like official Bantam kind of like promo had said something about that. Mm-hmm. And George responded to them and said, I never said anything about Dany. That was added by Bantam. Please disregard.
Huh.
And I'm like, why?
What are you playing at, Martin?
And he said, well, I think some of the hype is overblown, but that is the nature of advertising. There are a few bits and scenes and suggestions in the text from which one can extrapolate certain things and concoct theories. I mean, I kind of think with him, I think him writing Fire and Blood, I mean, he had a large percentage of it already written from back when he was working on A World of Ice and Fire. I think the exercise of him going back and, you know, fluffing it up and finalizing it so that it could be published, I think that that might have unstuck him in some ways, because I think that he was having such intense writer's block with The Winds of Winter and was just so like, I mean, this is me completely projecting based on his blog posts and stuff.
No, I've got the exact same theory.
Yeah, it just seemed like he was so like, that was so messy and like depressing for him that for him to turn his attention to Fire and Blood and just kind of like get back in the world, churn out some stuff, maybe plug in a couple like foreshadowing clues. I think that that kind of like freed up his brain a little bit. And the way that he talks about The Winds of Winter now, like just in the last month or so, is so markedly different. Like, he posted something, I think just a couple days ago, where like, do you remember that big, the big sad New Year's Day post about The Winds of Winter, where like he always attaches an emotion to his blog post, and that one was just depressed, and I like it just depressed me, like I felt so bad for him. But he just did another one, and this time I'm trying to find, I think that the emotion he attached to it was excited, and he says that he calls it his fortress, but apparently he has like a special cabin where he goes when he is kind of more focused on writing, and he says that he's there right now and that he's working on Winds. So I don't know, I'm trying to keep my optimism, even if it's maybe unfounded, but I think that it might have done the trick for him. My other kind of pet theory about Fire and Blood is that George is probably under contract with his publishers to get out a certain number of books. And I think that they might have hit a point where they were like, all right, you're clearly not giving us The Winds of Winter anytime soon, so like we need to publish something, so like what do you got? And he was like, well, I have 1200 words on or 1200 pages on Targaryens or whatever, so I like, maybe it was more of that and less him personally being like, I'm far more interested in the Targaryens than Winds of Winter right now, and possibly more of his publisher being like, just give us something that we can slap your name on. And
that also explain, because as we're going through like all those, like, you know, pages where it's just people you don't know and very, very thinly sketched characters, I'm like, man, it seems like the thing to do would just be cut all this and be like, the Grand Council met, and after much deliberation they appointed so and so as the Hand, and here are his qualities. And instead of, like, you know, having four or five of these suitors that you just dismiss out of hand, you introduce them just to dismiss them, like, you know, do one volume of
he's like changing the margins on his term paper to get it to, to 12 pages.
Right. I owe at least two books of 700 pages to my publisher. So what can I do to inflate this?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show again, and I am very excited to be able to see your complete and your unofficial guide to Game of Thrones. That seems like a very cool project, and you have such great attention to detail. I'm sure it's going to be something that fans are going to be interested in. Do you have a street date for that, or is something that you guys, because I know you're in the process of writing it, so it's many, many moons away.
Yeah, so I'm in the process of writing it. My goal for the book and what it is going to be is a complete unofficial guide, so from start to finish of the series. So I'm going to be wrapping up my final chapters of the book as the final episodes are airing in the spring.
Oh, right. You're going all the way through season 8. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so our aim is to have it on shelves by like September or October 2019. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. I would love to have you back for some thoughts on season 8, and when your new book comes out, that would be cool to cover too.
Of course.
I feel like I'll be doing Game of Thrones stuff for a while, until I or the watching public is sick of the HBO prequels and the Martin sequels and the history books and all that kind of stuff. So I'll be around and covering it for the foreseeable future. And you always got a slot on this podcast. Kim, if people want to find you and follow you and partake of your fabulous content, where would they go to do that?
So you can find me on insider.com. You can search Kim Renfro, and I'm sure my author page will crop up. And you can also follow me on Twitter. I'm at Kim R. Renfro, and I post all my stuff and just other miscellaneous A Song of Ice and Fire and Game of Thrones thoughts there all the time. So come say hello, and thank you so much for having me on. And I always love our chats about this world, and it's been great.
Yeah, I'll put links to all those things that Kim just said, so you don't have to punch them into your browser. It'll be nice and convenient for you. And thanks for coming on the show. Joining me now is Chase Stone, an illustrator. And you've probably, if you're a Game of Thrones fan, you've got the World of Ice and Fire. You're probably familiar with his work. If you've played Magic the Gathering in the last few years, you're certainly familiar with his work. Welcome to the podcast, Chase.
Hey, Aaron. I'm happy to be here.
I mentioned Magic the Gathering, the World of Ice and Fire. It's funny because before we started working together, you were, I think, one of the lead illustrators on the... what was the Egyptian-flavored Magic the Gathering pack?
Amonkhet.
And I remember, because, you know, I've always said that when it comes to magic, well, if anything, I'm kind of a lore whore and an art whore. And I remember it's been 10 years since I've been away from magic, and we just played some random, like, you know, booster draft with my buddies. And I was like looking at, like, you know, all this really cool artwork. And I especially paid attention to, like, the depiction of the gods. And I was like, man, that's just really, really freaking amazing. And I found out that you were the, like I said, the kind of lead illustrator in that particular project.
Yeah, well, I got all the artwork for the gods, so I illustrated all five of them, but I also attended the concept push, like 10 months earlier, where you go out to Seattle and work with a few other artists for a few weeks, like at the headquarters. And so I did the concept art for all the gods too. So yeah, those guys are like top to bottom, my work. So if you didn't like them, it's my fault.
They're hard not to like. And I want to talk about what other kind of projects might people have seen you from professionally.
Well, yeah. So the Magic, World of Ice and Fire. I did a couple of years ago. I did a lot of work for Applebot, like Legends of the Cryptid. That's another card game.
Mm-hmm.
I've just started doing work for Artifact, the new Dota game,
mm-hmm.
and beyond that kind of stuff, it's probably less stuff that like Game of Thrones fans would be familiar with. It's more like advertising, editorial stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Book covers. I did a textbook for West Point a couple of years ago.
Oh, the military academy?
Yeah, yeah.
That's
doing a bunch of like soldier illustrations and stuff.
That's wild. Yeah. I was wondering like if you kind of one of the questions I want to ask is like, is fantasy, like high fantasy art, kind of like something that suits you naturally? Is it a passion of yours, or is it just something that pays the bills? Or because I kind of blows my mind to think you're just illustrating pedestrian everyday stuff.
Right. Yeah, and the funniest thing is that up until I'd say like just earlier this year, I mean, growing up, I was really into science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I always, in my mind, thought of myself as like a science fiction artist. And then in April, I got hired to do this whole illustrated book for Coheed and Cambria.
Uh-huh.
And it was a sci-fi project, right? And one of the things that they were nervous about was that I didn't have any sci-fi in my portfolio. And they're like, so can he do sci-fi? So yeah, I guess I'm a fantasy illustrator now, but I always thought of myself as like science fiction.
Man, that,
but I do love fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, they are kind of joined at the hip. Traditionally, if you like one, you have at least a pat. I've never met someone that's into sci-fi and hates fan. Although I guess Jim is the closest. He's kind of got like a massive blind. Like, he enjoys Game of Thrones, and like, he's one of those guys. He's not going to be an asshole. It's like, if you hate country, you still got to kind of like Johnny Cash. So like, if the best of the genre, he enjoys and pays attention to, but. I also think it's kind of funny that like someone would be like, can you do, like, if it's staggering to see someone like look at you draw a picture of dragons in combat in the sky and be like, I wonder if you could draw a spaceship. Like, maybe he just can't make those shapes come out of his fingers.
No, you'd be amazed some of the stuff you hear. Like, I've heard like art directors for like advertising.
Uh-huh.
They'll look at your portfolio when you have realistic depictions of like everything, and they're like, but can he draw a sneaker? Some people have a hard time like kind of extrapolating,
No, clients are hilarious. No matter what, mm-hmm. whether you're doing web design or science fiction art, they're just, it's funny. I want to talk about how you came to be involved in Gods of Thrones, because I did the Kickstarter and we're raising this money, and I'm like, Anthony and I are talking about like, man, we're going to have to, go out and search the internet for a ragtag team of illustrators and artists and whatnot to do some of this stuff. And you contacted me through the Kickstarter, and talk about how we got in touch.
I mean, yeah, it was as simple as that, where I was listening to something. I don't remember which podcast it was, but you did like an advertisement for your book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you were talking about hiring artists and commissioning artwork, and I was just listening, and then it was like maybe like an hour later where I realized like, oh wait a minute, like I make art. Like, I could do that,
Yeah.
And, I've been listening to Bald Move for, a long time. I think I started listening to you specifically, like, when you were doing the Night's Watch.
Oh, right, with Mad Brew. Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. And so I've been listening for a long time. And, I was just kind of excited at the idea of kind of contributing to something related to Bald Move. I've gotten like all these hours of entertainment from you guys while I'm working, and so I just thought it'd be really cool.
No, I was thrilled. And there's, so we've we have actually done a lot of most of the professional engagements we've had in the last 3 or 4 years have been like leads that we followed from, you know, Bald Move listeners kind of heeding the call, and it's always amazing to see like what kind of talents and that people come up with. But even still, like, you know, when you're, I felt like you kind of soft pedaled it, because like, hey, yeah, I do art, and you know, check out my portfolio, and I'm like, okay, because like, you know, you never know it's going to be, because it's like the American Idol concept, like it could be someone that just does MS Paint, and I look at your portfolio and I'm like, holy shit, this is actually shit from the world of Ice and Fire, oh my god. So I was really, really pleased, and I'm glad we were able to hook up. I was curious about kind of what got you into art, because it's funny. I had a dream of being an artist when I was in like junior high and high school. I wanted to be a comic book artist in particular, and I drew and painted and took every art class I could. And I got into my early to mid-20s and started like focusing on my IT career, and I don't know whether those are just impossible to mix in one's brain, but it kind of like withered and died, and you know, I haven't kept up with it. But I was curious about why you got into art. Was this kind of like your dream career or what?
Yeah, I mean, what you were just describing is pretty much what I was doing when in school and as a young kid. So I was always drawing since I was really little, and my dad, you know, he works for CBS, but he's a really great draftsman as well. Hmm. And so we would always draw together when I was a kid, and and it was just something that I always wanted to do, and I just sort of like had the good fortune to, you know, have parents that were supportive, and was able to go to school like the focused on illustration.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to, you know, just sort of come out of school. I met my agent at our senior show, and then I sent my work to Magic as I graduated. And so pretty much right out of school, I was able to start working professionally. And then it's just sort of been, And then I've just sort of, one thing has led to another over the years.
It's amazing, because like, I feel like there's probably a lot of frustrated artists. Like, it's that easy? For fucking real.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, but a lot of things had to line up just right. Like, you know, I had a friend who was interning for my agent, you know, and I guess with Magic, that is just sort of like, yeah, you send your work in and, you know, you get hired or you don't. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
It's funny, because it's like, it's amazing. It's like hard work and dedication are like a requirement, but it's like just like getting those little lucky breaks. So important to getting into any like podcasting or art or whatever.
Yeah, without a doubt.
I was curious about like some of your influences. Like growing up, I know that like Art Adams and Jim Lee and Marvel Comics were like guys I looked up to and thought like their art style was particularly something that I kind of wanted to emulate and adopt as my style. Do you have any kind of influences or people that it could be like artists, musicians, or whatever to kind of inspire you or you look to for like inspiration?
Well, definitely as a kid, I would go through my art of Star Wars books like over and over again and draw stuff from those. So I really loved, you know, like Doug Chang from the prequels, and you know, Ralph McQuarrie from the original trilogy, and you know, those guys were pretty huge. Even like Drew Struzan, you know, the poster artist.
Mm-hmm. I'm not familiar with his work. I know Chang, Doug, and I just spaced the McQuarrie. Their line work is just amazing. I remember, because you know, people's got opinions on the prequels, but Chang's just like the stuff he was able to do with a marker is just amazing.
Yeah. No. I mean, obviously, yeah. You say what you want about the prequels as stories, but the design work in those movies are pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and but yeah, so it's like those guys as far as like design goes. And then with artwork, I think I really enjoyed like Caravaggio's work as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, like, my work nowadays doesn't, it's not trying to emulate that, but it's his work kind of made it click for me that lighting is just as can be just as important a part of an image as, you know, the characters and the composition and every other element, right? So that was pretty big for me.
That's a nice jumping off point, because I want to talk about your kind of technique and style, because one thing that, like, I think jumps off the page to me and even Anthony is, as you mentioned, your use of light. Like, you pay really close attention to, like, it seems like where the light is coming from. There's lots of, like, translucency and, you know, characters being transfixed by, you know, like, shafts of light and whatnot. And it's almost like there's a lot of, like, almost pre-Raphaelite. Everything just looks, like, glowing and beautiful or, like, dark and inky. What do you call that the style? Are you, like, all digital, or you still do some traditional work? Well, how do you achieve that?
Yeah, for my professional work, yeah, I'm all digital. And, you know, like, I do, like, warm-up, like, traditional sketches sometimes, you know. But, yeah, otherwise, yeah, it's all just digital and Photoshop.
Do you do, like, is it Wacom tablets, or you use a big Surface tablet?
Yes, yeah.
Really? Okay.
Right now I'm just using, like, a Wacom Intuos tablet, and I'm probably going to get a new Cintiq pretty soon. That Cintiq is the big screen tablet.
Yeah. So you actually, because I haven't got a lot of digital experience, but I have used a little bit of Wacom tablets, and it's a little bit of adjusting process to, like, draw on a thing that actually draws on something else. Not having the actual thing, so you're looking at it and drawing and all that kind of stuff, but
yeah, it definitely takes some getting used to.
And then, so how? I mean, this is kind of like probably just like, well, you just practice a lot until you get the effect. But, like, what? How do you think about those terms of, like, light? Do you actually think about, like, where the light is coming from and what surfaces are bouncing them off, or what? I mean, because, like, I look at the cover of our book, and it's if you don't know, it's these first men that are setting fire to a weirwood tree, kind of depicting the first clashes between the children of the forest and the first men. And it's essentially it's something the dead of night, and there's snow, and these guys are holding torches, and, like, it seems like it'd be very hard to get all that stuff planned out and make the colors look just so. Is that just something you kind of intuit, or is there a process to it, or?
When I'm coming up with, like, a composition and stuff, yeah, I always feel like it's really important to make sure that all the light in the image is, like, diegetic, right? Like, it's coming from somewhere within the piece, you know, as opposed to, like, you know, I see a lot of artwork where they treat it like a kind of like a camera shoot and sort of like place lights,
right,
you know, around the scene that don't really exist in there to kind of like get the effect that they want. But I always want all the lighting to be coming from something, you know, natural. Like the closest thing to would be just like, you know, light from the sky, like where maybe you can't see where it's coming from, but you can intuit that it's coming from, you know, like the sky.
Right.
You know. Something, yeah, you can always tell where the light's coming from. But yeah, like, I'm really big on getting proper reference when I'm working, you know, and so, like, that usually means, like, me, like for most or almost all of my work, like, if there's any characters in the piece, like, I've probably posed for those, you know, so I'll take, like, pictures of myself.
That's like an Alex Ross kind of thing. He's big on, you know, and of course, yeah, he's also, like, photorealistic type of painter, so I guess there's something to that.
yeah, you always want good reference, you know, and that helps, too, with, like, working out where the light's coming from and stuff. And then, you know, in addition to, you know, taking pictures of myself, like, I'll set up little scenes, like, well, like, you know, back in the day, like, I would do, you know, another artist that I was really inspired by is James Gurney, like the Dinotopia guy.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And so he creates, like, these really detailed maquettes and stuff and, like, sets up whole scenes and lights them and in order to, you know, as reference for his paintings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would do kind of similar stuff like that, you know, like I'd make stuff out of like Play-Doh and, you know, I would go as detailed as I possibly could. Like one of my favorites was for like a magic card where a guy is like stomping on the ground mm-hmm. and like creating this ripple when the ground is all breaking up. Mm-hmm. So I put, some plaster on an old rug and let the plaster dry so that then I could bend the rug and then all the plaster would crack uh-huh. right in a believable way. And then I would reference that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So I was going to say, when you say get as detailed as possible with this Play-Doh, like you're not just rolling Play-Doh snakes and stuff. Do you have some interest and skill in actually sculpting and molding? Or are you just trying to get the basic shapes to see what the light looks like on them?
With that kind of stuff, it would just be like the basic shapes. And I mean, these days, like all of that work has now become digital too.
Really?
So, like, I'll do like rough blockouts in like 3D.
Hmm.
You know, that serve the same purpose, but it's much faster than setting up like physical stuff.
Sure. Do you kind of miss the practical thing though? Or is it just like,
a little bit, because like that, the rippling effect on the ground, like that's kind of a neat little thing, you know, to describe to people.
Right.
And it was like a fun process, you know, and it was like a break. And now it's like, you know, you can't really describe like, oh yeah, I set up like a plane with a displacement map or something, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. Yeah. After that, then, you know, it's more or less what you'd expect with like just the drawing and painting and everything. But I always try to like, you know, get as much information as I can. And that's before I start working. So that's both in research and then also in reference.
I was wondering, like, your personal involvement with Game of Thrones. Like, I know you're, like, a science fiction guy, but were you, before you got tapped to do, like, World, were you a fan of the series or a fan of the books, or?
Yeah, at that point, I definitely was. I got familiar with the series when the show premiered, and then, you know, I watched most of the first season, and then in between episodes, I think 8 and 9, I read the first book.
Uh-huh.
And then, finished the season, and I read all the books. And so by the time I got tapped to do World, I had read everything, and I was like, I was pretty involved with it.
What was it like to work on World? Like, did they seek you out? Did you submit? Like, I'm not sure how this stuff kind of works. Like, is it kind of like in Hollywood where like there's a cattle call and people submit their headshots and you submit your dragon shots and then you hear back from them? Or did they like, hey, we really like what this guy's doing over at the Wizards of the Coast with Magic, and they contacted you? How did that come together?
Yeah, this one, like when I do Magic, like that's sort of considered like an in-house gig. Like what I did with you guys was like an in-house gig where it's like between me and the client. Mm-hmm. This one was something through my agent, mm-hmm. Richard Solomon. So he got contacted by the World people, and they had like a few artists, you know, including me, that they were interested in. And then he contacted me. I said I was interested, and then we started a back and forth. But yeah, it's actually kind of funny. Like, I haven't actually solicited work. Like, this project with you is the first time I've actually solicited work since I graduated.
Well, I've
usually it comes through like commission requests and that kind of thing.
So I was going to say, I was going to follow up with like, how did like working on the World of Ice and Fire compare to like Magic the Gathering? But it sounds like it was like completely different from. But it's still, I'm kind of interested because, and it sounds like you've been you've been involved in like Magic from like multiple different like levels. Because I used to, when I was into Magic, I would like pay attention to the lore stuff and they'd interview artists. And my understanding is like when you are called on to illustrate a card, they have like pretty descriptive things of like what they want to see. You know, it's pretty detailed. Mm-hmm. And then like I'm wondering, when someone, like, just one of the things you illustrate in World of Ice and Fire is the king who knelt. I think it's mm-hmm. Torrhen Stark surrendering to Aegon. And what was the, what how much detail did you get as far as, like, you know, this thing should look this and they should be wearing this kind of armor and it should be in this kind of setting? Was it like that detailed, or was it pretty broad, or what?
Yeah, no, I think it was just sort of like a little paragraph. I mean, it is a bit, it is pretty similar to Magic in that, yeah, I get like kind of a brief art description. And then I was fairly free to kind of just, yeah, I mean, when it comes to armor and that kind of thing, that was like completely up to me and the other artists working on our pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there wasn't any, you know, sometimes with Magic you'll get some concept art or you'll have a style guide.
Uh-huh.
And so there was none of that with World.
I was curious because, like, I, you know, we went back and forth talking about, like, the cover of the book, and, you know, we kind of described, like, kind of a couple of things that might be cool, and it wasn't very detailed. And when I got it back, like, I kind of marveled at, like, you just kind of, like, organically came up with armor that, like, if I had a thought to describe, like, what would the first men kind of wear? It's like a lot of like mm-hmm. Bronze Age. It's a lot of furs and skins. It's kind of, you know, it's recognizably Westerosi but primitive. Like how do you make those decisions? Do you have like a whole bunch of like internet diving where you go and look at the distant elements of armor? You just kind of freestyle it, or is it just coincidentally pick the right things? How does that come together?
Right. Well, I looked up what descriptions there were of the first men, right, in the book, and it mentioned bronze.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, there's always like a research period where I'll just sort of like go down, you know, just do a kind of a broad image search and see if there's anything that I find, and then if there's anything that I do like, you know, I find out what that's called and I'll search on that and you know, just sort of go through, like, spend a few hours researching stuff. And yeah, I think the armor that they're wearing in the cover was based on this bronze armor piece in a museum that I got a few shots of that I can't quite remember.
Is it Norse? Because I think I might have, because there's like a bronze helm piece that is like from some kind of Scandinavian Norse Viking culture that kind of some of the helms the guys were wearing reminded me of.
Yeah, the helmets were inspired by those guys. I felt pretty free to kind of pick things from different cultures and stuff,
right?
Because you know, the first men are like a fantasy civilization, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, as long as it was all within kind of that Bronze Age,
mm-hmm.
like area, then I felt comfortable kind of sampling from it. So yeah, the helmets are a bit Norse, but the armor itself is like more like scale armor kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of a little different. And, you know, yeah, I wanted it to feel of that time, but also like a little unique, right? Like it's not just Vikings. Right.
Right.
It's a little different. And yeah.
I was curious about, you know, do you have any like personal favorites? Like, what's your favorite illustration you've done for like George Martin's World, like World of Ice and Fire, or whatever? Do you have a personal favorite?
I mean, out of the World of Ice and Fire ones, probably the Torrhen Stark kneeling.
Mm.
All of the, you know, I did like, it was like half really like widescreen, like 21:9.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like Lawrence of Arabia, kind of
right.
Ultra widescreen.
Epic
and then
scale.
There's also ones. Yeah, yeah. And then there's also the other half were like these more portrait ones.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of the really widescreen ones, I think, came out really nice.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like Torrhen Stark kneeling, building the wall, this Targaryen, was it a Targaryen character? Prince Garen.
Mm-hmm.
It was Prince Garen being defeated by the Targaryens was another one
mm-hmm.
that I really liked.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say also the ones that I've done for you guys now really aren't any different from World of Ice and Fire illustrations. Like that cover could have easily been commissioned by them.
Yeah.
And I really would have gone about it the exact same way.
That's
so, you know, those count too. And I think that I'm pretty proud of that cover. I think that cover, I like just as much as those ones.
Yeah, the cover's incredible. I have a soft spot for your, because we, you know, to kind of try to stay out of trouble with George, because, you know, you don't want to, you just want to jack someone's intellectual property. We try to stick to illustrating things that, you know, are pretty broad, and also things that are like coming from more of like a fan theory that may or may not happen. Like, we had you illustrate a particular potential combat between two gigantic brothers, cause, and I don't want to name the name because I don't want to dig out the hip-hop air horn sound effect that I'd have to pipe in. I'm trying to keep hype levels down, but like, I really, really, on a win, like, you know, when we kind of decide this, like, you know, it's like, hey, one of the kind of the fan theories we do in the book is this Roose Bolton as a vampire lord. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because like, that's, I don't know if you've done any vampires from Magic the Gathering, but I've always kind of liked their takes on, you know, and the way vampires kind of look and move. And I just like, mm-hmm. hey, what if we just did, I kind of had, okay, what if it's Roose Bolton as vampire? And I kept on, like, here's a scenario where he's just kind of like, you know, looking over the ramparts of the Dreadfort, and you can see, and he's, you know, it's kind of muted. And I got crazier and crazier. It's like, but, you know, like, what if we just go for it? And like, Roose is full on vampire and he's attacking a Stark retinue. And there's a dire wolf that the Stark Lord tried to warg into to fight him off. And it's so badass, man. I love it so much. I can't wait till we finish, because one of the Kickstarter tiers that we're still in production is the poster tiers. And I cannot wait to get a poster pack, because I'm going to hang that sucker up in my office in a place of honor, because it's so cool.
Yeah, that one was a lot of fun.
I wondered if you have any kind of upcoming projects that people might be excited about. Things that you're doing for WotC, or things that you might be, you know, something. Because now that I know you're a science fiction guy, I want a campaign to get you to illustrate. Because the Expanse released like a very minimalist role playing game, and it had. It's only about 16 pages. It's like kind of a proof of concept that I think if the Expanse takes off, like I think it will, it's crying out for a redo. And the art's kind of, you know, okay. Now I know you're a science fiction guy. I want to see your take on the Expanse universe. Do you watch the Expanse?
No, I haven't started yet. I mean, I know it's, you know, I mean, it's on my list. I know it's kind of amazing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it starts off kind of slow, in the almost exact same way that Game of Thrones does. It's like, who the hell are all these characters? How are they related? But like, by the fourth episode, it's like, in fact, I think the fourth episode of season one is kind of universally said as like, this is where everything kind of clicks, and they have their first big kind of space battle. I would love to see your take on that universe. I think it would fit you like hand in glove. So if I have any pull in geekdom at all,
yeah.
I'm gonna try to make that happen. But do you have any actual project that people could be excited about?
I mean, right now it's mostly just like Magic and Dota is what I've been working on the past few months. You know, I do have probably in the next set, because you know when sets come out, the artwork is like almost a year old at that point.
Right.
The set coming out now has maybe one of my favorite illustrations that I've done.
Can you talk about it, or is it like all under wraps?
Really.
Oh man.
Yeah, no, I'd get in trouble. What? But it's just a cool image, you know. So I'm excited for that to like be public. But yeah, that's all I can really.
Talk about what's the name of the block that's going to be?
It's the second Ravnica.
Ah, okay. Well, I'll definitely check out that. Plus, it's really cool. Like, one of the things I did, like in the early stages of there's a Magic the Gathering online art search where you can it's like a codex or something where you can see every card ever created. And one of the filters you can do is by artist, and you can like go and like see like everything that Chase has done. And or you can go to his website, which chasestoneart.com, which I am including a link to in the show notes. I highly encourage, if you're a fan of fantasy art or just really done well done just artwork, it's definitely worth checking out, because you have got a lot of talent and you've practiced and worked hard, and it really shows.
Thank you.
So I think that's all I got. I really appreciate you taking, because I know you don't do a lot of like interviews and publicity. So I appreciate you coming on to the show and be willing to answer some questions. And I just tickled to death to work with you. I can't wait to see all the finalized stuff for Volume 2 that's coming out this spring. And can't wait to see that new Ravnica block. If it's one of your favorites, I'm sure it's going to be awesome.
Yeah, Ravnica Allegiance. Just remembered.
There you go. I'll be looking for that the next time I play some booster drafts. Chase Stone, mm-hmm. Thank you for coming on our podcast, and I'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks for having me.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R. R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk Podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
Wow, Anthony, we haven't recorded them yet, but those interviews sounded amazing. I can't believe how insightful that our buddies Kim and Chase were. Can you?
I am anticipating being thrilled by these interviews.
So we have a little bit of feedback. Actually, we have a lot of feedback. We had by standards of these book podcasts. So I want to get to that. GameofThrones@baldmove.com is where you send in feedback, where you can discuss it on our forums, forums.baldmove.com. Just a reminder, this is our last kind of official piece of coverage until more towards the spring. We will have a kind of a bonus podcast where Anthony and I are just going to talk about religion coming out in the next few weeks. And that's, you know, it'll probably be loosely tied to Game of Thrones because most of our conversations kind of are.
Yeah, kind of more contemporary religions and our personal relationships to these things.
Yeah, if that sounds entertaining, great. If not, it won't hurt my feelings if you don't want to hear.
You will hurt my feelings, but it's okay. You won't see my tears. I hold them in.
All right. By the time he comes back in the spring to talk about Volume 2 of Gods of Thrones, he will have dried his eyes. So I want to get started with Mario P., who has a question that I can't believe hasn't come up on the podcast yet, because I know it's like one of the things that immediately came up with the AMA we did on Reddit. Within the show, we see magic being used by different practitioners, but how is magic inherent to the metaphysics of the show? In other words, is magic like the Force in Star Wars, where anyone who has a knowledge and capability is able to wield it, with only their motivations determining whether it's good or evil? Or is magic a tool or will used by a sentient and eternal being like a god? Essentially, is magic an extension of the will of a god, or does supernatural magic originate from a supernatural god? Or could it be that the various religions have appropriated magic, ritualized it, and made it sacred, the cornerstone of their religion that establishes that religion's authenticity? Much in the same way Paul and the early Christians appropriated Jesus, according to the doctor of theology Brett Ehrman and Gerd Ludemann. So I'm not familiar with those gentlemen.
No, you're not?
No, huh?
All right. Okay, keep going.
Says he wraps up, I use Game of Thrones and Westworld as an artifact of study when I teach philosophy and ethics at my college, and these questions are what caused the greatest debates within my classroom. I'd appreciate if you and Anthony would do a deep dive in his grand metaphysical question. So, a fellow scholar and teacher and molder of minds asking for help on this one.
Yeah.
What do you think? What's the deal with magic and gods on Game of Thrones? Are they real? What's up?
Yeah, it's a good question, and one I don't think that Martin really wants to answer. We will see. I think he wants to sort of leave it to you and I, Aaron. He wants to leave it to us to write the definitive take on religions in Game of Thrones. But there are two things to consider. One is that the magic is either infused in the seasons and weather. In other words, it's just part of the setting. So Martin has said that the season, the irregularity of the seasons is actually has some sort of magical impetus. So it's just sort of it's baked into the setting of the story, and so it is as part of the world as the weather would be. And so we hear winter is coming, and we also know that that means that the White Walkers are coming, and yada, yada, yada. So that's part of it. So there's some sort of cosmic force, a la Star Wars. The other way to look at it, which was alluded to in the email, was that based on this sort of cosmic reality, different people have it interpreted in different ways and ritualized it in different ways. And so someone like Melisandre will come along with a fully developed religion based around some sort of supernatural reality. But the religion itself is just an interpretation of the reality and not sort of the definitive explanation of it. So R'hllor, there's no R'hllor, in other words. That would be one way to look at it. What do you think?
So there is some kind of fire element that may or may not have a consciousness and a point of view, but it could be just an elemental force, and they're just slapping the word R'hllor on it to describe all these things and coming up with rituals to try to harness that power.
Right. And I think Mushroom has this line in the book where he says, well, the regents were selected by the gods, but turns out the gods aren't very smart anyway.
Yeah.
And I wonder if there isn't something there, even if it's sort of said as a jape, I wonder if there's something there, like, look, you're not going to be able to find some sort of personal God that's going to answer your prayers. There's some sort of cosmic force out there, but don't trust in anyone that claims to have sort of a good handle on how it works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think there's another possibility that we haven't mentioned, and I think it's most possible when you're talking about the gods of the North, the old gods, which is the god, like, so you've got these ancient tree-worshipping entities, the children of the forest. They then convert the men, and we know that these people that are very strong green seers, eventually their fate is to merge their consciousness with the weirwoods. And they live on, okay? And when, you know, like when Bran sees this cave beneath the weirwood tree that the three-eyed raven has made his home, the three-eyed raven at this point is over 100 years old, and he's kind of like this desiccated corpse that has tree roots growing through it, and there's a hall of like these old singers that has like, you know, all these bones and of like the people that have come before him.
Right.
And you get the idea that it's entirely possible that the northern gods are just these legions of old green seers and tree singers that have melged in like a very Avatar, Naboo type culture.
Right.
That,
so
that,
the
that they've all gone to the trees.
Right. According to Jojen and Snowy Locks up north, there, eventually these green seers sort of upload their consciousness into Skynet, and or not Skynet, but like EarthNet, TreeNet,
and Weirwood.net.
Eventually they merge with the old gods, thus becoming something like the old gods. Maybe becoming an old god. In volume two, we talk about this. You know, maybe Bran is on his way to becoming a god in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I thought that's interesting that you could have. So maybe the world started as an elemental force that humans and these children could perceive and then manipulate. And as they got stronger at it, they were able to transcend the bonds of death and eventually become the gods that they've always worshipped. Out of like some kind of ignorance or ritual.
That's right. So like in dance, we learn that second life is a big thing for wargs or green seers. So if you can, you know, you're about to die and then you project your soul or whatever consciousness into a bird or a wolf or something like that, you can get yourself a second life. But let's imagine that you are able to project your second life into a weirwood tree that lives forever.
That's one of the things that I did not know. I mean, it's pointed out in the margins, but weirwood trees are one of those creatures that unless they're disturbed, they'll just live forever. And their wood once cut does not rot, which is, you know, obviously a huge boon for a medieval society.
So, yeah, so those are just a few ideas. And like I said, I'm not sure that Martin really wants to answer those questions, but I think he wants us to be asking those questions.
Yeah, because I'm not sure whether he wants to or answer. I will say that he has, at this point, you can say that their magic is for certain real, but is there personal gods that you can, that will intercede in your behalf? That's the question to me that's interesting, and I think that's the one that he has so far refused to answer. And until we actually, I mean, but the other thing is, like, as we point out in our book, you could easily describe dragons as gods. You could easily describe the White Walkers as gods.
Yeah, in the if you took like a Norse mythology sense or an Egyptian mythology sense,
right,
they are functioning in the story as gods. They're not gods in the Judeo-Christian sense.
Right, they're not like omnipresent, omnipotent, omniscient kind of gods. But so until So that kind of God steps forward. Like, you could already argue that humans are already communing with what, you know, like you said, Norse culture, and to the extent that the Northern religion is based on, you know, shamanism and Norse mythology and Celtic traditions of tree worship and druid traditions, then that we might already have met all the gods that this universe is going to offer. They're just not super impressive from a
or they're dormant kind of standpoint. You know, that, you know, there's Bran is not at the height of his powers yet, and Dany is not at the height of her powers yet, at least in the books, but once these two are, they're pretty far above the realities of mortals at this point.
Let's move on to Evan W. It says, I'm waiting to see what Santa has in store for me before pulling the trigger on the book, but it's on my radar. Hey, it sucks because I'm the type of guy that if I want something, I go out and buy it, but I intentionally black out like from the time of my birthday in August till the end of December because like, oh, I don't want to step on someone's gift idea, right? Like, I get it. Do you think that we're going to see a corresponding surge in book sales on December 26th? As legions
I'm looking into my crystal ball, and the answer is yes. Millions of copies.
Legions of disaffected Game of Thrones and Bald Move fans whose families did not get the copious hints that this is what they wanted, and they didn't have their stocking stuffed or their trees fortified by the gift of gods.
Or they got an Amazon gift card for someone who couldn't come up with a better job, and they used it to great effect.
There you go. Let's get back to Evan. In the last episode, you guys discussed how dragons refuse to fly north of the wall. Based on the quote from the book that I read, I agree it seems that Gurm intentionally wants readers to notice that. But the Double D's just had Dany fly north of the wall with a squadron of dragons. How should we square that circle? That would seem to me too large of a plot point for the Double D's to make up completely. Any speculation on why Dany's dragons overcame their fear of the wall? Boy, I mean... this is unknowable right now because I think that the Double D's and George Martin are in a little bit of a snit with each other. And I think the Double D's are like, oh, these are your bullet points, old man. Well, fuck your bullet points. Because I don't think there's any way to square that. Now, maybe. There is some kind of confluence that will allow the Ice King to steal a dragon. Because that's pretty fucking cool, honestly. But it's going to be a way more convoluted magic and plot involving horns and blowing and walls shattering and oaths being sworn and broken and betrayals and treachery. It's not going to be just, hey, how about we go up and get an ice zombie and capture it so we can just rub it in Cersei's face. Oh no, we lost a dragon. I don't think there is a way to square that without just a lot of work. But
the other way, I mean, if we're going to go this direction, the other way to look at it is to say Martin saw the last season, thought, oh, these guys are idiots. I'm actually going to write a chapter in this upcoming book that makes it impossible for dragons to fly north.
Just to show them. Yeah. Oh, there's one other opera. I've thought about this, too. There's also one other idea that you can fly a dragon north of the wall, but they'll only obey the call of Azor Ahai, or the prince that was promised.
Since
we think Dany is at least half of that figurehead, if not the whole enchilada, then maybe that's why the dragons are like, sure, boss, whatever. We're getting information.
We will wait and see.
We will wait and see. We might be waiting a long time if we're talking about Winds of Winter and Dream of Spring. VH, for your information, on your last podcast on Fire and Blood, you guys mentioned that you were unaware of a historical analog for mushroom. Goddamn fucking mushroom. Holy cow. If I never see another mushroom in my life, it'll be too soon. I was actually reminded of a somewhat famous historian named Procopius, I think is how you pronounce that, who chronicled the history of the Byzantine or Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian I, who reconquered much of the Western Roman Empire in the 6th century. Procopius was, or Yeah, Procopius was an insider to Byzantine court and the chief legal advisor to the emperor's best general. However, after years of service to his emperor, he became very disillusioned with him, in particular his wife, the Empress Theodora. In his work, The Secret History, it gets pretty insulting towards the emperor and at times even pornographic. Here's a passage from Wikipedia regarding the empress's late-night shows as an actress. I quote, "Often, even in the theater, in sight of all these people, she removed her costume and stood nude in their midst, except for a girdle about the groin. Not that she was abashed at revealing that, too, to the audience, but because there was a law against appearing altogether naked on the stage without at least this much of a fig leaf. Covered thus with a ribbon, she would sink down to the stage floor and recline on her back. Slaves to whom the duty was entrusted would then scatter grains of barley from above the calyx of this passion flower, whence geese trained for the purpose would next pick the grains one by one at their bills and eat."
Hey, that's a great catch. I am not up on my Byzantine history and wasn't aware of this particular historian, so thank you.
Are we sure these geese aren't just actually Zeus trying to get one last trans-species poke before he shuffles off into the dustbin of discarded gods? And, you know, he felt the Christ breathing down his neck, and he's like, one last time, I'm going to transform into a bull or a flock of geese, and I'm gonna eat some cereal off a naked lady. Yeah, that's a ticket. This from all the relatively from a relatively well-respected historian who is thought as the most important historian of the early Byzantine Empire. At other points, he also suggests that the emperor is possessed by a demon and Theodora is possibly a sorceress. Procopius didn't release the secret history during his own lifetime, and it was discovered after his death. Well, that's a red flag. It may not be as lewd or outright sexual as Mushroom, but the parallel of royal insider leaking out the real happenings behind the scenes is there. I'm very pleased to be corrected on this record, because this sounds...
Yeah, me too.
This sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Moving on to Jasmine. "I'm on the last third of Fire and Blood, trying to finish before you do your last podcast, and I'm on the chapter Under the Regents, War and Peace and Cattle Shows. Lord Unwin Peak is emptying the dungeons and meting out punishment for thieves, murderers, etc., but it got me wondering, is there an option for women similar to the Night's Watch? If they were found guilty of a crime, did they just have to take the punishment? Maybe they could join the Silent Sisters. It seems rather that unfair that men could keep their limbs and whatever else so long as they headed to the wall. But then again, a lot of things for women are unfair in Gurm's world, so maybe there is no answer." It's my understanding that the Silent Sisters are kind of that little outlet for women.
At least for high-born women. I think that there are a couple examples in this book where, you know, if a highborn daughter is, we don't know what else to do with her, that right. We'll try to send her to the Silent Sisters. So at least for some of that, there's also this, unfortunately, this is a historical detail. It's the law of gallows and pits. Does this ring a bell for you, Aaron?
I have heard it mentioned, because I just got done listening to this 7-hour podcast by Dan Carlin on essentially public executions from like antiquity to current day.
Right.
And in some of that, I think that they talked about that there's actually
right. So
this
it's
is
the
like
right,
a penal code.
Yeah, it's the right of a lord to decide who's going to be executed. And for the men, they get the gallows, and for the women, they get drowned, which is, of course, probably where we get the whole drowning of witches tradition. So it sounds like capital punishment was used often. In our real world history, there was no such thing as the wall. There was a Hadrian's Wall, but that was manned by Roman soldiers. It was not manned by otherwise disenfranchised members of the realm.
I also think the Silent Sisters is not like that wasn't as automatic to the extent that taking a black was automatic. I think it was like something that the Lord could decide to do out of mercy, or it's something that the woman could ask for. But it's not like it is in the Baratheon period where you can essentially take the black to get out of any kind of jail free.
You know what? Now that I say that, I want to do a quick caveat here. because I lived in Durham, England for a while I finished my dissertation. There was, during the medieval period, a time where if you could get to the front door of Durham Cathedral, no matter what your offense was, and you could reach the knocker, like the knocker on top of the door, and the priests would let you in, you would have at least 30 or 60 days reprieve from execution, and you could sort of get your matters in order. And it was respected by almost all of the lords and ladies that if you could get to Durham Cathedral, which would be in the north of England, then you would have some kind of reprieve, even if it's sort of a temporary stay of execution.
Just so you can get your will and your affairs and all
or
that.
Or hire a good lawyer. I don't know.
That's true. There's also a lot of weird stuff, because like I read quite a bit of historical fiction, and one of my favorites is Patrick O'Brien, and there's a whole plot point where the hero of the story is subject for arrest for debts, because, you know, the whole debtor prison, that's a great idea. Guy can't pay his debts, throw him in jail till he can. But apparently there was all these little tiny squares of London that, because of ancient things going back to the time of like the first Magna Carta, that the whatever prince or baron or duke still had sovereignty, and none of the crown's debts could be collected on those lands. So a lot of the you know, skips on their debts would rent an apartment in these liberties.
That's interesting.
And then the bailiffs couldn't go and get them. So,
right.
Crazy. Let's move on to Eric S. I've noticed that the show and the books place attention to the fact that Joffrey and his siblings have blonde hair as evidence that they're not Baratheons. And Gendry, in turn, is the spinning image of Robert. In fact, the author and the showrunners go to great lengths to demonstrate through physical descriptions that families tend to have common traits. This leads me to wonder, why is it a common belief in Planetos that Oris Baratheon was a half-brother to Aegon Targaryen? Shouldn't there be some kind of Targaryen trait in the Baratheons that would confirm their lineage? If Aegon's father was Oris's father, Oris should have some Targaryen features. Instead, the Baratheon's description is completely opposite that of the Targaryens. So I ask, could this mean Oris Baratheon was not a Targaryen bastard, or could they be half brothers through their mother? Well, I mean, Fire and Blood pretty much settles this and just outright says that, you know, Oris is the half brother on his father's side. Well, no, does it actually say on his father's side? I thought it did.
I forget, but he is connected to the Targaryens, even if baseborn.
Yeah, and that's like, there's a lot of people trying to kind of figure how this fits in, because I read a thread on the Song of Ice and Fire Reddit where people were saying when John Aaron's talking about the seed being strong, he's not talking about Robert Baratheon in general. He's talking about the Baratheons. Like, if you look all throughout, like this Baratheon trait of these. Bristly beard, curly black hair, physically imposing gentleman goes back to the dawn of their house some 300 years ago. So, and again, every time a Baratheon pops up in the story, they're all Bobby B types. Right. So now this is, I have long maintained that this is the stupidest fucking thing in Game of Thrones, period. This just Punnett squares, what are those? The seed is strong, horror, horror. Like give this simple-minded medieval mystery to Ned so he can figure it out, and the seed is strong, and that's the thing. Like it's I can't see it as anything other than really fucking stupid. But it could be magic. It's maybe the laws of Gen X are governed by magic, just like the orbital mechanics of the planets on Planetos.
So here's how I take this. Martin was using this as a literary device so that Ned would eventually learn that Cersei and Jaime were doing the Tower of Joy dance. That is the full extent to the purpose of the Seed is Strong. I don't know if you can parlay that fact into a larger sort of in-world reality that Martin wants to develop. I just think it was specifically to create a conflict in a Game of Thrones. I don't know if it tells us anything else about the way genetics works on Planetus.
Hmm.
That's my take.
Okay. I still think it's the stupidest thing that happened in the, okay. the books of Game of Thrones anyway.
Hot take by Aaron. Hot take.
Russell W. So this is the Norse heathen that introduced himself so many weeks ago. Says, while we're on the topic of Fire and Blood book, the Gods of Thrones and the new trailer that has dropped for Season 8 with the Wall of Ice, meaning Wall and Fire, I think it's very relevant given my heathen ways and the conversion or conversation on religion in Westeros to touch on a few things. So, if you haven't seen it yet, HBO dropped a teaser trailer. It's less than a minute long, and it's essentially the painted table, the famous painted table of Aegon the Targaryen. It's carved in the shape of Westworld and painted to look like Westeros. Yeah, yeah, we got Thrones World coming to season 3 of Westworld. They're cashing in, baby.
I always thought Aegon the First was an android.
Well, I mean, it explains his stern and kind of boring demeanor, honestly.
Yeah.
So if you haven't seen it, it's essentially one side of the table is freezing. And, like, you can see, like, you know, they have all those, like, little chess pieces in the shapes of lions and wolves and kraken and whatnot. And they're slowly icing over and being consumed by the frost. And then from the opposite side of the table, like, it's lit on fire. Like, it's being flambéed. And you see the flames devouring lions. And they come to the middle and just explode into this, like, kind of wall formation. Mm-hmm. And that's the trailer he's referring to here. He goes, the title of the story, A Song in Ice and Fire, and the theme of ice and fire is a constant throughout the story, as one might expect. But this, it seems, is inspired by, if not taken directly from Norse mythology. Now, Anthony, you have not actually been exposed to this email yet, but I can't wait to get your reaction. A creation of the cosmos starts with the Ginnungagap, a void, a bottomless abyss. Then, to the north of the void, spawn Niflheim, an icy cold and dark place, and then to the south of the void came Muspelheim, the land of fire. Now, I might be, but he gave me a helpful pronunciation guide for Gunungagap, but none of these others. So, the land of fire, sparks of lava, that's where Surtur, the fire giant, lives with a flaming sword in hand. A very brief rundown, the streams of water that flowed from Niflheim and the sparks and fire from Muspelheim met in the void, creating the perfect conditions for life. Game of Thrones plays on the idea of these opposites with fire and ice, and there are many comparisons that one can draw between the two that I'll leave for the sake of discussion, but the symbolism of ice in the north and the fire in the south of the wall in the middle is significant. Even in Ragnarok, the end of all things has a place of Game of Thrones, or in Game of Thrones. Before the gods are defeated, there's a long winter, three consecutive winters, where the said brother will fight brother, wars will rage and famine will take hold, disease will plague the land, all before the forces of ice and fire face off against the gods, of which the apocalypse will erupt. Afterwards, under the branches of Yggdrasil, life is reborn. In Ragnarok, the majority of the gods all die. Having known their fates beforehand, they rode forth in the battle anyway. Some of them, however, survive and are at their end to start anew. Also an interesting note, in the Norse creation myth, Ymir, the giant, is slain, and from his bones, teeth, hair, brain, and skull, our worlds are created. Sounds a lot like living inside the blue-eyed giant called Macumber, which is a Game of Thrones lore. This is pretty cool, because this is essentially a synopsis of one of the chapters in Volume 1 of Gods of Thrones.
Right, so it sounds like maybe our friend, what's his name?
Russell.
Russell. Sounds like maybe our friend Russell has not gotten to the Frost Giants, Crueler Gods chapter in our book, and has arrived at some of the same conclusions we arrived at in parallel. So we're happy to meet you in the middle, Russell. But I think he's right.
But when we do, we'll explode into fire and ice and right. That's what happens. That's what happens.
Yeah, I call fire. So so I think he's right. I think that there is something about the White Walkers that parallels the Frost Giants. I think that there's something about the mythology of Macumber that sort of hints at the body of Ymir. And I think, and this is something that we started talking about really early on in the process of writing this book, So I was able to kind of craft this with Aaron's help. But I one of my theories is that that the wall, although it does sort of echo Hadrian's wall, I think we actually do have an idea that is drawn from Norse mythology that there is basically a wall that's keeping out the giants beyond the edge of the world. That's a very and the wall is made of Ymir's eyelashes. So I think that maybe Martin is nodding in this direction. I don't know if it's going to sort of say, okay, well now we can sort of project how the story is going to end. In the same way that Norse mythology ends, I think this is one more ancient mythology that Martin has co-opted and put in service to an original narrative. That would be my take on it.
Let's move on to Steve S. So now that I'm done with the book, and I think he's referring to Fire and Blood here, I can say that I'm unsurprisingly happy that I read it, yet underwhelmed at the content provided for overall world building. I was really expecting a few more explicit connections to the Targaryen reign and the Game of Thrones storyline that we all know and love. Anyone else a little surprised the book ended about halfway between Aegon's the First conquering Westeros and Bobby B sitting Iron Throne? I'm not surprised because I actually think a lot of the stuff that we're expecting to get is going to be in the next volume. Because the Blackfyre Rebellion sets up so many of the situations and the characters that we are still dealing with in Game of Thrones. Like, if nothing else, like that's the origin of Brendan Rivers, the three-eyed raven.
Right.
And you've got all these plots in Game of Thrones that, you know, it's like, oh, is this this Aegon that John Connington is warding, is he actually a Blackfyre rebel? How is Illyrio and Varys, you know, related to all this? Like, I think that's going to be coming in volume two. But he has a couple of thoughts about the book that he wants to discuss. Who can actually afford a faceless man? There sure seems to be a disparity between the cost in the show and in the books. Hashtag even the thin man was gettable. I think it's a thing that anyone can afford, a faceless man. It's just the cost is always going to be dear and higher than you want to pay.
So it's maybe like on a sliding scale, like, okay, so I see that your entire net worth is one golden dragon. So we're going to take half of that.
Or we're going to take your daughter. Or something. Yeah, like it's going to be steep. It's going to make you whistle and pucker and think, "Oh boy, I don't know if I can afford that," no matter if you're a king or a pauper.
Or maybe there's no rhyme or reason to it at all.
Maybe they just do it as a joke.
They throw joke. Some dice and they're like, "Oh, it looks like you got off free. We're going to kill everyone you want us to kill for free."
Yeah. It's like, you know, we haven't offered many to the God of Death lately. The God of Death might be getting restless. Let's have a sale.
I wonder if they do like a Black Friday sale for the faceless men.
Right. Yeah. It'd be a Black and White Friday to represent their doors.
Ah, there you go. There you go.
Aegon III's reign, continuing with Steve's points, was a weird one to me. I can't peg what his affliction is. He's not mad, lusty, a learned man. He doesn't really like anything and was often described in a way that would make you think he was simple, but that just doesn't seem to fit. Thoughts on him? I think he's just a very traumatized individual.
Yeah. Well, look, he saw his mother eaten by... Is he the guy that saw his mother eaten by a dragon?
Yeah,
and then he tries to exert. Oh, and he's married off to his 8-year-old cousin or something like that.
And then he's lived under the shadow of war his entire life and under threat constantly.
Yeah, and then he tries to exert some influence and he gets basically spanked. So I mean, this is not these Targaryens are not this is not sort of the example of a healthy family unit in general.
No.
But yeah, he's a poor kid. He had no chance.
Yeah. There sure is a lot more Valyrian steel in Westeros than I thought pre Game of Thrones. Where are these blades now? Such treasure items wouldn't be lost to history in this short span of time, right? Yeah, I mean, there's been some people that tried to track down like all the Valyrian blades we know about, but I mean, I never thought they were as scarce as they're laying on. And I also, it slightly strains my credibility that Tywin Lannister couldn't get himself a Valyrian blade. you know, right, with all the minor houses that have them and the amount of gold that he was able to give. Like,
there is a little bit of a nod that some of these blades, you know, we got a lot of people, you know, sort of traveling the world and not coming back. So maybe they're lost to the bottom of the ocean or whatever.
Well, we know that's how that's how the Lannisters lost their blades. Was it Garion the Bold or whatever went forth to colonize old Valyria, and he never came back, and he brought their Valyrian blade with him. So,
right. We do get to meet Ice for the first time. Cregan Stark brings Ice. It's mentioned that he was going to use Ice for the execution. But, you know, these are like the previous email said, you know, some people really love those kind of Easter eggs and some people roll their eyes at them. And so you're always sort of risking something when you drop something like that in a prequel.
Finally, Mushroom was sort of given a final word in this book. I think there's something there that we should be connecting to Tyrion. I didn't think that, but that's kind of interesting.
If it is, I'm not sure what it is. I mean, there was that one quote about the gods, which is somewhat similar to what Tyrion says while he's waiting his execution in King's Landing in the cells to Jaime. That the gods are somewhat parallel to Cousin Orson, and he is a little person, and he is somewhat irreverent. Maybe he's a type. He's a type. I don't know. I don't know beyond that what I'm supposed to draw from those parallels.
I think that because that's I do like with some of the lurid details Mushroom gave us here. It reminded me a lot of Tyrion's false confession in the Vale in front of Lysa Arryn, that you know he confessed to making the bald man cry and to milking his eel into someone's fish stew and like all this, it's all this other, this just ribald bullshit. I think that him and Mushroom would be good drinking buddies.
Or they'd hate each other because they're too alike.
Or they'd hate each other because all Mushroom would see is the amount of privilege that Tyrion has, and all Tyrion can see is this guy's squandering, who knows. That's the last point for Steve. Let's move on to Mark H. Gentlemen, first wanted to thank you for your coverage on Fire and Blood. It's keeping me plugged into the show while I wait until April, and Gods of Thrones was so good, I made sure to go and leave a review. Well, thanks, Mark. I appreciate that. Anyway, I want to talk about Fire and Blood from the point of view of someone who has had to read for his job. I'm a middle school librarian, which means I end up reading a lot of young adult titles. Oh, boy. They tend to have somewhat predictable nature.
You know what? That sounds like a fantastic job. I love that job.
They tend to be somewhat predictable in nature, and sometimes I catch my brain shutting down and not really paying attention to certain passages, usually because they don't pertain all that much to the plot. I'll still be able to walk a student through the major plot points, but sometimes I'm not all the way plugged in. I found the same thing happening as I read Fire and Blood, and that never happens to me when I'm reading anything meant for an adult audience. While I can say that I don't feel like it was time wasted, there's definitely some interesting stuff in there. I'm not sure that telling this story required 700 pages. I think Anthony nailed it when he said that 10 pages go by with nothing and then the 11th would be great. However, that's a pretty low percentage of goodness.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not wrong. And I'm also wondering if this book being split into two was more about George really wanting a little extra time with the Blackfyre Rebellion, because he knows that really connects a lot of stuff and he wanted to get that just right. And it'd be hilarious if we end up waiting 5 years for volume two.
I think as someone
because he's
who,
paralyzed.
Right.
He's paralyzed with which bastard should lay with Sierra She-Star to make, I don't know, whatever.
Well, as someone who reads ancient history for my job, I can tell you that's a lot like this book is a lot like reading someone like Josephus, where you do read 10 pages of the Jewish war and you're thinking, man, this is really dull. And you get to that 11th page and you're thinking, oh, wow, that's fascinating. I didn't know that. And that connects to this and this. And it could be that's what Martin's going for. He wants this to read like a medieval history or an ancient history. And let me just reiterate again, I would love to be a junior fiction librarian. If anyone knows of a job, I will take it. That sounds like my dream job.
You might be careful with what you wish for, because I can totally see how, because the stuff he's talking about, his eyes crossing and skipping, I'm thinking, because, you know, I read The Hunger Games, and, you know, after Katniss Everdeen tries her 30th dress on for the different pageantry of The Hunger Games, I'm like, okay, this part of the book isn't for me. But I don't know. Yeah, like everything.
My view on junior fiction is that good fiction is not age specific. That if it's good junior fiction, that just makes it good fiction, and everyone will enjoy it no matter what their age.
Yeah, no, I can get behind that. Last up, Taylor H. I am a longtime show lover and really enjoyed this podcast. I've began recently listening to the books on audiobook, and I have a question about The Hound. Why do you think that The Hound has an affinity for the Stark girls? I just finished Clash of Kings, and there was multiple times where The Hound genuinely cared for Sansa in a fucked up kind of hound sort of way and showed her kindness. Then I know later in the show, at least, The Hound takes Arya on the roadshow and cares and protects for her for about a year. What was it about these two girls that softened his heart? I have been thinking about it, and I'm not sure what it is about them that made them act this way. Would love to hear your thoughts. I don't know, because I'm not privy to the Hound's internal thoughts, but it seems like for Sansa's part, that he was kind of genuinely touched by how naively she believed in knights and honor, and then, you know, her being just wretchedly treated by the court, by these people that she looked up to and revered, I think struck a chord similar to his experience, you know, of being victimized by his brother who was an anointed knight. And it's like, you know, he's a victim, the one to spare another person, someone that's maybe more innocent and still had a chance to get out of there and lead a normal life. Some people see it like a romantic kind of thing between him and Sansa. I never got that. I think it's more of like, I don't think there's a weird dynamic where Sansa's terrified of him, but also piteous.
Well, he tries to terrorize her. I mean, he'll say things specifically to scandalize her or scare the shit out of her. And I think that, I mean, look, the Hound's a complicated character, but at the end of the day, I think Martin sort of has him as sort of a scoundrel with the heart of gold, which is totally against Sansa's view of what a perfect man looks like. You know, she's got a very superficial sense of sort of a knight in shining armor. And it turns out that her knight in shining armor has half of his face burnt off, and
his armor's not that shiny anyway.
And I should also point out that, you know, I don't know if he has any great affection for Arya first off. I think he kidnaps her because there's something to be gained monetarily. And she eventually grows on him, I think. But he's not quite as developed as a character at that point in the story, I don't think.
So there is our thoughts on one of the chief skeptics, the Hound, who gets his own chapter in our book.
Well, yeah, I guess more on the Hound in Volume 1.
In Volume 1 of Gods of Thrones, available now at great retailers near you, like Amazon. And if you are interested, again, one final plug on this podcast, Gods of Thrones is available in paperback and ebook. You can go on Amazon and get it. There is convenient links right here in the show notes that you are listening to. Most podcast apps display that, but you can also find them on any of the articles for these podcasts on baldmove.com, or if you just search for Gods of Thrones on Amazon, boom, there you go. That is it for this week's show. Thanks to our guests, Kim Renfro and Chase Stone, for taking time out of their busy schedules to chat with us about Fire and Blood and their experiences with that and Gods of Thrones. And last but certainly not least, thanks, Anthony, for joining us on the podcast for these last few weeks and sharing with us your insight and your information and your wit and humor.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. I've been really excited to get connected to the Bald Move community a little bit better. And, of course, I will not be a stranger. in any sense of that word. I will not murder you, Aaron, in other words.
You won't be the seven-headed god of death.
I promise
of
not
the faith
to
of seven. Okay. You will not be a ill-tempered horse that the hound would ride. That's another stranger in the canon.
No guarantee on that one. I might actually do that one.
So if you're down here, me and Anthony talk about religion, we'll have another podcast out in a bit. If this is your final stop, then we wish you well, and we'll see you back here in the spring. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Anthony.
See ya.